giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here today with Sam Thippen. Hey, Sam.
Hello.
So I feel like the way that we met is actually kind of an interesting story that
yes.
maybe we could start with.
Yeah.
Which is that you started harassing me.
Yeah, that is true.
And sort of stalked me until I agreed to hang out with you.
Yeah. that is not wrong.
That's like pretty much what it was.
Sure.
So we had never met. Do you want to tell it from your perspective?
Sure. I mean, I was going to my first ever Ruby conference.
I know, that was like, your first.
Yeah. I don't know anyone here. That guy did a talk. I do some open source. Maybe he'll want to program with me. And mm-hmm. then he did, and it was nice.
Yeah. So I think you reached out to me on Twitter.
Yeah.
And just said, hey, like, want to hack on some stuff while I'm there?
Uh-huh.
At the time, I just said yes.
Yeah.
I didn't know who you were, but I was like, yeah, sure, fine. Uh-huh. Probably expecting you to not follow up.
Uh-huh.
And then you did.
Uh-huh.
And I think there are actually two useful lessons in there.
Uh-huh.
One is that generally if you ask people for things, a lot of times they'll just say yes.
Yeah.
Like, especially in this community, it feels like people are pretty nice.
Yeah, for sure.
And the other thing is that you got to follow up.
Because
I said yes, but I was not going to go hunt you down.
Yeah,
but
sure.
you tracked me down, and then we did end up pairing.
Yeah.
And actually, it turned out that you were a fun, interesting person, and we started a little friendship.
Thank you. And also, I got to troll you really hard with the RSpec internals.
Yes. So, yeah, what I didn't realize is that I was signing up to hack on, like, legacy RSpec pieces that had, like, all kinds of nasty Unicode formatting things.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We were doing the Unicode differ bug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was awful, in a way. But it was fun. I mean, like, I love pairing with people that I haven't paired with before.
Uh-huh.
You always learn things.
And yeah, for sure.
You know a lot about the RSpec internal, so I got to like get a peek at that, and it's
mm-hmm.
that's always fun. Like,
yeah,
getting kind of a tour around a code base that someone else knows pretty well is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I like trolling people by being like, hey, do you want to pair on some open source? And they're like, yes. And then I show them RSpec, and
surprise, it's a mess.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like whenever RSpec is discussed about being a mess internally, I need to sort of caveat it with the fact that, like, A, it's been around forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, RSpec 2 is 5 or 6 years old now, and RSpec 3 is coming up to 1, and all of the people that work on it are, like, you know, somewhat pressed for time, somewhat busy,
mm-hmm.
And so, like, the work everyone is doing is, like, really excellent, and we're all just a bit pushed, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the people that work on RSpec want the code to be legacy and smelly. It's just how it happens.
Right. And there's because the code base is large enough, there's lots of pieces that don't get looked at anymore that
for sure
have, you know, would be written better if they were written again now.
Right, exactly.
But no one's going to just go rewrite them unless
sure.
it's you and me pairing at RubyConf, in which case
right.
you're like, oh my gosh.
Well, we were fixing a bug, right? And then the urge to refactor appeared, and
right.
there were, like, we pulled 2 or 3 objects out, and like those are still in there today.
Hooray.
In one form or another.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I think I got my name on those commit messages, maybe.
You did.
Nice.
Yeah.
Contributor list.
Yeah.
That's another life hack, pro tip,
uh-huh.
hashtag. Pair with someone that has commit bit on an open source project and just get them to
push
put you on the git commit
yeah.
message, and then bam.
Yeah, for
you're
sure.
a committer.
Yeah, although, like, obviously, that went through a review.
Of course.
Sure the tests were passing.
Right.
This isn't Bundler. We don't just YOLO push to master.
Whoa. Bundler trolling.
Yeah, well.
Would you say that if the Bundler team were here?
I actually did some pair programming with Andre Arco at a conference called Frozen Rails. And
Helsinki?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he literally just pushed the commit straight to master.
Wow.
And only the build on 187 broke.
Yeah.
But it still broke. And I was like, oh dear.
Yeah.
And now my name is on the, like, red build of Bundler Master.
I remember being shocked, speaking of 187, about how many different versions of Ruby RSpec continues to support.
Yeah.
What's the list currently?
So it's 187, the whole 1.9 series, and 2 plus, obviously.
Wow. That's like, nice of you.
Sure. Well, at the time of RSpec 3, which was the last time we actually modified the list of supported Rubies,
mm-hmm.
187, whilst sort of end of life, was still used by a lot of people, and it didn't make sense to, like, just cut them off, right? And, like, Bundler, for example, speaking of, still, like, uses RSpec and still supports Ruby 187, and, like, it would have been rough and weird to, like, force Bundler to use an old version of RSpec
mm-hmm.
In order to write their tests, right? And, like, Aspect 3 had a lot of new goodness in it, and we didn't, you know, we don't want to be the reason that people have to upgrade their Ruby interpreter.
Yeah.
That said, from Aspect 2 to Aspect 3, we did drop 1.8.6 support.
Right.
And because Semva, we're not going to drop more Rubies until Aspect 4 happens, whenever that may be.
Yeah, gotcha. Do you work on other open source stuff besides RSpec?
Not primarily, although having done RSpec a lot also sometimes causes me to need to reach out to other projects because, you know, it touches every part of the ecosystem and make changes there. There are a small number of gems upon which RSpec depends that necessarily the maintainers for might not be as engaged as RSpec maintainers are, and so sometimes we like sort of push them to merge our pull requests and do releases because we expose a bug in their gem.
So what made you pick RSpec?
It's a really typical story. I encountered a bug, I fixed it. I noticed that some refactoring could happen internally. I did like 9 or 10 refactoring pull requests on RSpec. And some months later, Myron, the guy that is the lead maintainer of RSpec, was like, hey, some of the people on the core team want to move away and we're looking for people to fill the slots. Would you like to join? I was like, sure, because I'm bad at saying no. And, you know, the rest is history.
It's funny, you were talking about the messy, or like parts of the RSpec code base being a little bit messy, and it strikes me how little it matters to people that use it.
Oh,
like,
for sure.
Like me, for example.
Right, exactly.
Like people constantly are like, I know that there are Rails contributors or people that look at go source driving on Rails and go, oh my god, this is so terrible. And like, it continues to be a massive success and people continue to not care at all.
Totally.
And like, eventually, like there is a, you know, there is technical debt there, right? So if it means that it's harder to do things and things come out slower, it does affect end users in a certain indirect way.
Sure.
But it also doesn't generally.
Yeah, I think our rate of release on new features and bug fixes is very good. And I also feel like our API is basically sufficiently well curated now facing the users that like that external interface is very unlikely to change, right? And it's all internal or small details that change. Like most of the like 100% legitimate, actually a bug reports we get are because people are mocking or stubbing on objects that have like slightly strange interfaces to them. Like the method has been changed or the send method has been changed or so on. And so like it's very rare that like what the user sees as RSpec changes a huge amount, right? And so much of what we do is very internal.
Yeah. That big change of getting away from like the should on object, that was 2 to 3, right?
No.
No?
No.
I mean, it's still there, right? I know it's...
So the should syntax is still there. And in fact, it's still turned on by default. And there are no plans to ever fully remove the should syntax.
Which I think is kind of hilarious.
RSpec. So it's a configuration option right now. And the decision might be made to turn it off by default in RSpec 4. But certainly, as far as I'm aware, there are no plans to ever not make it a part of RSpec.
That's good, because switching that was when RSpec sold out in my book.
What do you mean by sold out, Ben?
I loved the should syntax. This is Ruby. I say throw 100 extra methods on objects and let's DSL this thing. Let's go. I'm ready.
Yeah, well, like, it is not necessarily actually all that beneficial to stick a method on object. And for example, with proxy and delegator objects, the should syntax breaks very easily, whereas it's very, very hard to make an object which breaks the expect syntax.
Which is what everyone always told me, and I get it. And I think it's probably the right choice overall. It's just aesthetically, I suppose, from my soul likes it less.
It's just that you don't like doing more typing.
It kind of comes down to that. Like, and I tend to have to put parens with my expects and whatnot.
Yeah, because parens are so hard.
And the sentence, it just doesn't read as beautifully as it used to.
Maybe that is fair, but that is subjective.
Totally, of course.
And there are a number of, like, objective reasons why it is better, right? As yep. we've oft discussed.
Yeah, I think it's yeah, right. I like to give you a hard time about it, but I think it was the right call.
Yeah, and well, the other thing I think is one of the biggest wins with the expect syntax is that expect is the only keyword to actually start an RSpec expectation now, whereas with should, you had should receive and expect with a block to catch an error. Now mm-hmm. expect is always what you use to mm-hmm. set up an expectation, which is like a nice sort of brain hack for people who are writing tests, I think. And regarding the history, the expect syntax was introduced quite early in the RSpec 2 series. I want to say 2.11 or 2.10. Just in the RSpec expectations module, and then in 2.1.3, it was added for mocks as well. So the expect syntax has actually been around since before RSpec 3. Okay. It's just that when RSpec 3 came out, a sort of decision was made to like really start fronting it as the suggested syntax to use. The should syntax now very quietly tells you off if you use it, which is a warning that I added. Yeah, and
can I turn off that warning?
I think you can. I seem to recall it's possible. Yes, the way you turn it off is you explicitly enable the should syntax in your spec helper.
Okay, that's reasonable.
You can, and in fact, I think the warning tells you that. Yeah, it's been a while though.
I just like that you like deprecate this thing, only it'll never go away, only we'll yell at you if you use it.
Sure. Well, the warning is very explicit about that as well. Sure. It says this will be disabled by default. If you want it, please turn it on.
Right. Which is reasonable.
Yeah.
So there are some interesting new RSpec features in the works, I hear.
Yeah, so RSpec 3.3 is just around the corner, and I'm using it on one of my projects. I run a few of my projects on RSpec from GitHub on master because mm-hmm. we're pretty good about keeping our master branches green, and it's pretty rare that like a serious show-stopping bug gets introduced to them. So I wouldn't encourage most people to do this, but like I feel pretty comfortable in my own work like running RSpec off master because I can always debug it if necessary. And I did a thing this morning, and one of your colleagues was like, oh my god, I want that feature so bad. So I figured we could talk about that. So the one I was working with this morning is a failure we're calling rerun failures,
uh-huh.
which will basically, when you run your RSpec test suite, it will write the IDs of the examples that failed out into a file so that you can rerun all of the failures or an individual one and then iterate on that until it passes and so on and so on.
That is super great. I have wanted exactly that.
Cool. Well, so that's coming in RSpec 3.3, which is soon, hopefully.
So where's a file get stored?
You have to put a configuration block in your spec helper.
Okay. That says right.
Yeah, this
right
is where
failures here.
Yeah, so I'm calling mine .rspec-failures in this one project. And actually, the first time you try to rerun with only failures, if that configuration option isn't set, it will like tell you that that's what you need to do in order to get your failures.
That's very friendly.
Yeah, like one thing I'm always very impressed by is like how much work goes into the UX of RSpec. I think mm-hmm. it's one of the big like selling points versus some of the other Ruby testing frameworks.
Never heard of any others.
There are no other Ruby testing frameworks. Yeah. And then the other bisect, so the idea is that if you have ordering dependencies between your tests and you're running in a random order, you can give it the random seed and tell it to bisect, and it will output the smallest set of tests to make an individual one fail.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because RSpec now has a new internal notion of example ordering called IDs, which is the order their example groups and examples are defined within spec files and the order in which they're loaded, which means that like we can do stable ordering even of like randomized tests. So like running a subset of tests with a random seed will run them in the same order as if they were still placed within the entire test suite, right? Huh. Which is what enables this feature.
Yep. So how does this, I'm having trouble actually picturing the bisect. So like how do you figure out what the tests are that cause it to fail?
So, well, let's simplify slightly. So if you are running like your test suite only up until the point that you encounter one failure,
yep.
then it necessarily follows that, like, state changes from the earlier tests are what cause that test to fail, right? And so that is the same condition you need as you need in bisection search, right? Where your, like, array has to be ordered in order to do that. The, like, array here is the array is, like, state changes per example.
Yep.
And then you basically, you know, you run half the examples in each before in each case, and you see whether the test starts passing or failing again.
So it knows to look at that test that failed last time.
Yeah, so it's actually rerunning the example groups over and over again until it finds the smallest set of tests it needs.
That actually caused a failure. Huh, cool.
Yeah.
That sounds really handy when you need it.
Yeah.
Like, really handy.
In all fairness, there was a mini test bisect first.
Oh, okay.
But it's in it will be built into RSpec as of RSpec 3.3. It'll
that's
just
cool.
be
I mean,
in
that,
the runner.
To me, that's you should be copying each other. Like, good ideas should be copied mercilessly.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And we also know that Rails 5 is going to introduce a mini test runner for mini test style tests in Rails apps.
What do you mean?
So RSpec's runner is, like, one of the big selling points at the moment, because mini test does not really have a runner with a lot of features at the moment, right? And so my understanding is that in Rails itself, they are introducing a test runner for mini test tests for Rails apps that will have a number of the features of the RSpec runner. And that's, like, super great, right? Because these features in particular are not bound to one of the two testing frameworks, right? Like, a good runner should exist for both.
Okay. So Rails is going to provide that?
I think it's being provided by Rails itself.
Sounds a little weird.
Yeah, I don't know. This is just what I've heard through the grapevine.
Okay. So, getting back to open source a little bit, I assume, look at a lot of issues and pull requests and things like that.
For sure, yeah.
Do you have recommendations for how people can make your life easier / get their pull requests merged more frequently and things like that?
So, like, one thing we have, like, on RSpec, as you might expect, is a extremely high level of test coverage on everything that we do. Like, it's not actually 100%, but we will not accept new pull requests without tests. And if they're user-facing, we generally might ask for a cucumber feature as well, although we'll often just write that ourselves, because our cucumber features end up being user-facing documentation at the moment.
Yep.
But yeah, so, like, we need tests, just because otherwise we have to maintain the code that we merge, right? And so without tests, we don't know what it's supposed to do, whether it's actually works if we refactor it at some point further on, and so on. And then with issues, I tend to encourage people to open issues much, much more liberally than they do. When I'm sort of talking to people at conferences and whatever, I hear them just being like, RSpec totally broke for me. And I'm like, did you file an issue? And they're like, no. And I'm like, why didn't you file an issue? And they're like, I thought it was my fault. And I'm like, no, it's probably us. We're probably bad. Mm. Even if it turns out that, like, it is something that you're doing, I care much more about knowing the struggles that people are having, because that also allows us to, like, fix our documentation, fix our tutorials, like, publish guides or whatever. And, like, the volume of issues that we get is actually not so ridiculous. Mm. Like, the RSpec repos tend to have fewer than 50 open issues on them at any one time in total.
Yep.
Now, like, obviously, there are much bigger open source projects that only want issues that, like, have a solid, absolute reproduction case. But, like, we manage everything from feature requests to help requests to bug reports through the GitHub issue tracker that we have. So, like, it's a bit different. That said, if you're going to report a bug via an issue, please, please, please include a simple reproduction case. Because if we have to spend some time constructing something to try and reproduce the issue, it can be difficult to know whether or not we've actually captured the issue correctly in our test or whatever. And in particular, Doing that with Rails apps is really, really difficult because, like, the Rails environment is so sort of, you know, interconnected and there are so many moving parts. It can be really hard for us to reproduce an issue that you're having on a Rails app. And also, like, even a point release on Rails can, like, just disappear the issue. And so it can get quite complicated. So we often just ask people, please give us a full Rails app that we can clone to show this issue.
So speaking of pull requests, one of the things that you've told me is that Myron? Myron Marston is amazing at pull review.
Yeah.
Like you said this multiple times on multiple occasions.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, what to you makes someone awesome at reviewing pull requests?
I'm going to get in trouble now.
Okay. Why? Because he doesn't want the attention?
Probably, yeah.
Well, sorry, Mr. Marston, but you're too good at code review.
I'm not sure I can put it into words. I just feel like, in particular, the way Myron does it is he'll just, like, go over every single line of code, like, literally read the whole pull request in detail and, like, leave comments that both have, like, a deep understanding of Aspect's legacy and, like, Myron is clearly a very good engineer. You can just tell by talking to him and the way that he works. When I'm, like, doing pull review myself, I tend to just try and point out all the things that I find questionable or a bit strange. So, like, a really good example of this is when I was reviewing one of Myron's pull requests and I just got absolutely owned after leaving comments. So there was this situation where he was using, like, fetch with a default block with a return inside it. And I was like, wait, is the return keyword necessary here? I don't think it is. He's like, no, procs don't get their own stack frame, so this is going to cause the method to exit early, and it's an error finding. I was like, you're right. And also, I didn't think about that. And, like, yeah, it's basically what I'm looking for when I review pull requests is, like, is there good tests? Can I actually understand what the change is doing? Do I think this is the correct way to implement it? Has complexity gone up?
Yep.
And then, like, this was not true even, like, a year ago, but it's true now that we have, like, automated tools to, like, help us with so much of this stuff. So, like, we have RuboCop in our CI build, which will reject pull requests that don't match style. And, you know, if it's not green, we're not going to merge it. And we also have, like, multiple layers of test coverage, as I've already mentioned, which, like, I have a huge degree of confidence that if Aspect's own test suite is green, then we can almost certainly release. And actually, that degree of confidence kind of burned us on the Aspect 3 release. On Aspect Rails 3.0.0, like, the release, you could not install Aspect Rails into a new Rails application.
Mm.
And a hotfix was issued, I think, within 48 hours that dealt with that. But it was kind of like, huh. And that was to do with, like, bundler environments and gems loading and stuff. And so, like, by the time our test suite was executing, it was too late for you to be able to find this bug,
right?
Basically.
So I want to just go back for a second
sure.
to the pull request where you're reviewing Myron's thing and you asked about the return thing.
Yeah.
To me, that's okay. That's not getting owned, right? Like,
yeah.
I ask a lot of questions in pull requests that sometimes just get explained, like, oh, no, this needs to be like this.
Sure.
But that to me is healthy.
Yeah, it's completely agree.
Yeah, because if you had that question, someone else might, you know, you might have it again reading the code later on or something.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
I like getting that stuff out there.
Yeah.
So don't feel bad if that happens to you.
Yeah, it happens to me all the time.
Yeah,
right? And I'd like to think that it's not just me.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't think anyone should feel bad for that.
Uh huh.
But so Myron, he's thorough. He's a good engineer. He pays attention.
Yeah.
He reads the whole thing.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's friendly.
Yeah, he's very friendly. Yeah, for sure.
That, I think, is an underappreciated aspect of good code review.
He says that he just, like, tries to be respectful in all of the comments that he leaves, and I think it's useful to take that with me as well, right?
Like, yep.
Especially, like, potentially for people who are new to open source, like, it can be a very, very scary thing having your first pull request reviewed, especially by, like, if you know the names of the people that are, like, reviewing your code.
Absolutely.
For sure.
And I think there's incredible opportunity or incredible danger of having your comments misconstrued in text only. Where that you think of as mildly like chiding to someone is just an incredible insult or incredibly brusque. And
yeah.
So I try to just go totally in the other direction and make it like overly friendly, overly emoji and
like 9,000 sparkle emojis.
Yep, that kind of thing. Like that is, I think, worth the effort.
Uh-huh.
It's very hard to know how you're going to come across in text.
Oh,
I
completely
agree. It's so easy to get it wrong.
I often write a comment and then I come back to it half an hour later and I'm like, is this person going to think I'm an asshole?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you're not sure the answer is no, then it could be yes.
Yeah.
Because like you don't know what their mood is going to be when they read it. They could read it first thing in the morning after a terrible night's sleep, and it just comes off really nasty.
Yeah.
Like I've had people tweet at me things that like are clearly, like when I read them at 2 p.m. are clearly jokes, but if like it's like early in the morning, I'm like, what is this jerk saying to me? And it's just, it's amazing to how quickly your perception changes like that.
Oh, for sure, absolutely.
So that's one of my code review tips, is just assume that you're going to be interpreted in a terrible, terrible light, and so take aggressive steps to stay away from that.
I completely agree.
That's cool. Now, I just want to take 1 second to let you know about something I like, which is DigitalOcean. This is something that we use a little bit on Upcase, actually. So our Git server on Upcase is hosted on DigitalOcean. It's been really easy to set up. It's been rock solid ever since we put it on there. We don't have to think about it at all, which honestly, to me, is the ideal thing for hosting. But DigitalOcean provides simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers for as little as $5 a month. It's actually used by over 400,000 people now, which is pretty good. It's scalable. You can resize the droplets as you need, as you grow. Whole bunch of operating systems available. We got Ubuntu. We got CentOS. We got Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. I use all of those, of course, every day. I know you do, too. There's one-click installs for things like Rails, of course, and WordPress, and Node, and GitLab, and Drupal, and all those things. So if you're a Python person, if you're a LAMP person, whatever you are into, they got. Big beefy servers if you need them, tons of RAM, SSD hard drives, 20 CPUs if that's your thing, if you're doing all kinds of amazing crunching of numbers and data and whatnot, plus 99.99% uptime and gigabit speeds. So pretty great. If you are interested in trying it out, go ahead and head over to DigitalOcean.com. You can learn more. And when you sign up, please use the code GIANTROBOTS with a capital G and a capital R at checkout. That'll give you a $10 credit, and they will know that we sent you, which is awesome for everybody. So thank you to DigitalOcean for supporting the show. So you've been writing Rails apps for a long time.
That is true.
I'm curious, like, what are your Rails apps, the good parts? Like, what parts of Rails do you like and not, or do would you rather not use? Or,
you know, my mind changes about this a lot, which I think is actually
good.
Probably quite healthy. Yep. Actually, I think the best example I can give of where I've had like a complete swing is when Turbolinx came out. I was like, yes, this is the best thing ever.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm Mr. Single Page Web Apps Don't Work. And like, for me, I like followed along with the reasoning in the keynote, and I was like, sure, yes, yep, uh-huh, this makes sense. And then I just saw it break repeatedly so much. Like,
I'm not super clear. Like, what is it breaking? Why does it break things?
So, like, I mean, I literally the other week, like less than 2 weeks ago, I had a new Rails app which was just scaffolds, and I was like just clicking around, setting out, you know, making sure everything's working, and the back button broke on me. Just like straight up broke. And like the problem there is that like the actual underlying JavaScript implementation and APIs like have race conditions and stuff in them that are not well handled.
Huh.
And like if you browser more quickly than network responses come back or whatever, then you have potential race issues there and URLs stop working and stuff. I mean, I encountered this on GitHub literally in the first day of one of my client projects. I was like, guys, is your GitHub broken? And it was actually just like the web browser couldn't deal with the JavaScript anyway. Coming back to Rails though, like,
yep,
one thing I'm really impressed by is how like much of just like stuff you would want in a web app, regardless of your application architecture, Rails does for you. Things like the asset pipeline and like form generation and like the nested Russian doll caching, and it just has a bunch of these small individual tools inside it that aren't part of its core MVC remit, but make web application development much, much easier. And so even if you want to like defy the Rails architecture in some ways, you know, do something a bit like hexagonal Rails or whatever, it still has all of this stuff inside it that can really help you sort of on the outer layers, right? Like Active Record manages database connection pooling for you by default, and you know, it's really easy to do things like scale up and scale down, and it feels to me just like Rails is an extremely mature tool for doing web application development framework, regardless of its actual core architecture internals. And then, like, I go back and forth about things like whether using an ORM is actually a good idea or not. So James Coughlin, a good friend of mine, likes to say the database is a service, not that you should treat it as a collection of rows and models that you can arbitrarily query, right? The idea is that you have business questions, you're more interested in asking it than necessarily talking to the ideas of individual rows and how things are connected. I don't know. I hope that rambling answer was at all useful.
Well, yeah. Rails the good parts. Turbolinks out.
Yeah.
ORM maybe in.
Uh-huh.
What else? Callbacks?
No.
Callbacks out.
Callbacks out. Action cable.
Action cable.
No,
in or out?
No action cable.
Action cable out.
Yeah.
Delayed job. Job processing in general.
Interesting. Well, so like a lot of the projects I work on have components in Ruby and Python and maybe other languages as well. And so I look to queuing tools that work across languages.
What's your favorite?
So I'm actually, even though Sidekick does not have a Python client implementation, I am increasingly convinced that Sidekick is descended from heaven to save us all. It seems to be extremely robust and performant and like quite good, and one
good,
of the nice
good docs too.
Yeah,
I've had good experiences with Sidekick.
Yeah, and one of the nice things is that it's not coupled to your Rails stack, so you can put it elsewhere if you need to. Mm-hmm. Right. One thing about delayed job as it comes in Rails is that like that means you're using Rails. Although I was recently talking to Steve Klabnik about this, and he was just like convinced that queuing via Redis is going to die eventually when people realize that Redis is actually not all that good at being like strongly persistent against like machine failure and things like that. And he was like, use a real database or a real messaging queue solution.
Yeah, people are actually very tolerant of stuff not actually kind of working most of the time, I think.
Yes, I know.
Do you follow Kyle Kingsbury's blog?
No.
He does a lot of like aggressive testing of databases consistency claims
and
finds out that most of the time they don't hold up.
Uh-huh.
And people are just like, yeah, you know. It's like, it turns out most of the time, you can lose a little bit here and there, and the world keeps spinning.
Nobody will notice.
Sometimes they notice, but it's just overall, people don't seem to care that much.
Yeah, well, you know, I think...
Maybe that's a terrible attitude to take for the world.
Yeah,
but
like, there is this, like, attitude of brokenness that we have, right? Where, like, a little bit is acceptable, but then I always find that that little bit acceptable grows more quickly than you would expect. And so, like, when I have to run, for example, tech support for my family at home, I'm always like, how did computers get this way? Yeah. Well, like, why did I just lose an hour and a half to, like, reinstalling some printer drivers on my sister's laptop?
Yeah. Because you're the computer guy, that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't get that reputation.
Yeah, it's a bit late for that.
I've slowly gotten rid of that mantle a little bit in my own family. I don't know. I just do programming now. I don't really know.
Yeah, the problem is I worked at a laptop clinic when I was at university, and so my family is unfortunately precisely aware of how much tech support I have done in my life.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is a lot.
Yep. So Rails the good parts. Plain old Ruby objects in.
Oh, of course.
Big Active Record models out.
Yeah.
What else?
Is that not all of it?
I don't know. I guess is that the gist?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I say to like newer, more beginner developers I work with is I always try to strive to write things that look more like Ruby. And that does not necessarily mean more like Rails, right? Mm-hmm. Like, those things are different concepts. And so one example of this that I use a lot is I never, ever use the new hash syntax, because that way of describing a symbol does not show up anywhere else in the Ruby programming language. And
not sure what you mean.
So like when you write like symbol name colon,
uh-huh.
as opposed to colon symbol name.
Yeah.
Like that is unique to that hash syntax, right? But you can declare symbols in all sorts of other places within the Ruby programming language, right? And so I find that that is an inconsistent way of declaring that this thing is a symbol when compared with the rest of the Ruby code that you write.
Huh.
It also means that, for example, you can't mix the types of things that you have in your hashes, and also like quote and then something and then a closing quote and then a colon making a symbol is like an act of punching yourself in the face that I would rather not participate in. And so like I just don't find that the new hash syntax gives you anything apart from typing, I think it's like two fewer characters. And like typing less is not always a good reason to do something.
It's also in the parameter list now.
Right, but those keyword args is a direct result of the new hash syntax. But
yep.
I don't think that's like compelling enough reason to do it.
This is the second time I've heard you mention consistency in APIs as being a worthy goal. Yeah, I'm getting a theme here.
Yeah, and it's the same with things like how you treat objects and lists and so on. It's like I try and really strive to like do things that I feel are consistent within like what Ruby looks like. And I mean, certainly some of that is my view of what Ruby looks like. But
I remember you telling me about an app you worked on where you a lot of behavior was put in these sort of like method objects that just have a call method on them.
Yeah.
Are you still into that?
I go back and forth. One thing it gives you is all sorts of fun, pluggable behavior. And the other thing you avoid is like having the class name repeat itself with a single public method that is like the opposite, right? Like lawnmower.mowlawn.
Yeah.
One thing that's really nice is it means that you sort of naturally aim at small objects, right? If you're going to expose a single public call method, then your object is necessarily not going to be very big.
Yeah, we hope so.
You hope. And then like inevitably you like have a sudden deadline and you're like, I'm just gonna screw some extra behavior on the side here with like,
well, yeah, well, if you have one public method that can call like 20 private methods, no problem.
Yeah, for sure.
I know how to program.
And then you have like private methods calling more private methods and so
on. Do you think that's a smell?
So when I was a more junior developer, one thing I found myself saying was, I wish I could have like a second layer of private methods that can only be called from private methods.
Okay.
Because I didn't have a lever to like solve that problem in my head, right? And then I like realized at some point that actually you just cut more objects out.
Right.
And so I tend to find that if you have a lot of private methods all like calling nested layers of private methods that never really see the public method, that's a good place to cut out an object.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I would call that an iceberg class sometimes.
Yeah.
Where you have a big submerged private section that's doing a ton of work.
For sure.
Yep. And usually for me, the smell isn't so much the, hey, there's a bunch of private methods. It's, man, this is kind of tested through this one method up here that's like five jumps away. It sure would be nice to write a test that just tests this private method, but I'm not going to do that.
Sure.
So what if I extracted this and tested it?
Totally. And actually, it's interesting you mentioned that because I was helping a friend of mine at RailsConf with some of her tests. And I was looking around and I was like, wait, you're sending the public method with the symbol of a method you want to test to this private method. Then you're testing it. And then in afterhook, you're sending the private method, like the literal method that makes the method private. And I was like, you see, what you have here is an object screaming at you to be let out.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, yeah, I guess I do. Because like, that once that code is there, it's like, how do I test it? And obviously, lots of people are just like, I'll just call the private method. Actually, the first thing she said to me is like, would you just send the private method to the object? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that just takes wisdom. You have to have heard it from somebody or read something or done it yourself to realize, like, what I'm doing here is actually indicative that there's something else that should happen.
Right.
And those, I feel like, are the most important things to get in your head over time. Is like that spider sense, so that tingling that happens, you're like, wait a minute, I'm doing some serious gymnastics here. There must be an easier way.
Yeah, this is a lot of what I end up doing with my clients, actually. Like, I'm usually not brought in to help them solve their testing problems. Like, that is highly orthogonal to the thing that I'm meant to do. And then I'm just like, guys, we need to solve this before we do anything else, because this is punching ourselves in the face. Yeah. Actually, so the one I see a lot that I'm always very surprised by is stubbing the object under the test.
Uh-huh.
Which, for me, I think that might be my number one testing smell. If I see that, there's almost certainly something wrong.
So, like, we have an object, and I want to test, you know, method foo, and I'd stub out method bar on that same object to make sure that foo does the, you know, gets the result I want.
Yeah.
And that's a smell.
Yeah.
Why should I not do that?
So, the basic reason is that at that point, you're not actually testing your object. You're testing some hybrid object that includes both your test library's code and your code. And whilst most likely the test library code is vastly simpler to reason about, because stubs at the end of the day, whilst the internal implementation is extremely complicated, the actual what they do is very simple, but you're suddenly just not actually testing your code anymore, right?
Right. And so you've cut out part of the object and replaced it with something else, and so you're not really testing that the object
and
works.
Like, usually, a fun thing to do at that point is to literally comment out that method and run all of the tests and see if they still pass. And, like, about half of the time, they totally still do.
Wait, comment out the method that's getting stubbed?
Yeah, like, in and then run the whole test suite.
Okay.
And because you're stubbing it, it turns out you can totally, you know, your test suite might still pass.
I see.
Like I recently literally replaced this method, which was stubbed, which was doing a bunch of active record calls, with return empty array, and the whole test suite was green.
Huh. Because everything that used that object was stubbing it.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And so when you have that smell, what does that tend to indicate to you?
To me, usually people do it because they don't want to stub the, like, actual, like, usually that method has a dependency in it, right? Like an active record scope or like a mailer or something. And they don't want to actually do that because hitting the database is expensive or sending email is expensive, or like they don't quite get that you're totally allowed to also stub things that aren't objects, like constants, which are objects, but you know what I mean.
Yep.
And so, like, doing that is a fine, like, first step, because that sort of takes the smell down from, oh my god, you're not actually testing anything, to you're at least testing your whole object. But, like, usually having to stub some third-party API is indicative of, like, a different testing smell, which is that, like, it's hard for you to cleanly express what your dependencies are to an object.
You want to test object foo, which calls bar, and so, you know, the smelly thing to do is just stub bar. Next best is to stub the things that bar is actually calling that are its external dependencies.
Uh-huh.
And even further down the hopefully less smelly train is inject dependencies, like pass in the real dependencies for the object, or somehow isolate those dependencies.
Yeah, for
way.
Sure.
Okay. So stubs are for passing in, basically, not for overriding existing methods. Is that a reasonable rule of thumb?
Yeah, I mean, if you're stubbing your object under test, then you've got serious problems.
Things are probably wrong. You're not actually testing the object anymore.
Yeah, for sure.
Gotcha. Okay. So you heard it from here.
Yeah.
Watch out for that.
Uh-huh.
Awesome. Well, I think we should wrap it up there.
Sure.
It's been a nice little chat, though.
Yeah.
It's good to have you in person in Boston.
Thank you.
Do you want to plug anything or point people to things that you've done?
Sure. So I'm actually currently working on a video series called Effective Ruby Live Lessons with Pearson. And that's going to be a series of sort of short screencast tutorials on, like, little Ruby tips that you can use to improve your everyday Ruby workflows. That's actually still in pre-production. I'm filming it in 2 weeks. And so I can't give you, like, a pre-order link or code or anything yet. But if you follow me on Twitter, I will be tweeting about that when the pre-order goes live.
Awesome. Sounds good. Today's show was produced and edited by Tom Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/145. Thanks for listening.